this, but my name is Marcos Gonzalez. I'm the Housing Development Manager in the Community Development Department. Welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started on tonight's topic on housing rights. I want to also mention that as part of our efforts to educate and provide outreach in this area, we're bringing this event tonight and hopefully many more throughout the year. We do have a nonprofit here tonight that's going to help provide a presentation. And we're also here, city staff is here to answer any questions that we could answer. But definitely we want you to feel comfortable in asking your questions after we've gone through several slides with you. Try not to spend too much time on a lot of the nuances, because there's probably a lot of questions you might have. But today we have Sinai Gonzalez, who's helping us with running the PowerPoint and the Zoom. This meeting is going to be recorded, we'll let you know. We also have Bob Newman, who's our housing analyst, and Maribel Leland, our housing development manager. So we're going to go ahead and get started, and hopefully we get more people showing, coming and joining us now. So now I'll turn it over to Henry Mantel.
Hello, good evening, everybody. My name is Henry Mantel. I am a current pro bono coordinator, former eviction defense attorney for Neighborhood Legal Services of Los Angeles County. We're a legal aid firm, and I operate personally out of Pacoima. We have offices in Glendale and El Monte as well. And I am here because housing rights is a big issue right now, and I'm here to tell you as much as I can about it in the time I've been given. So, I need to start the presentation. That would probably be helpful. There we go. Okay. So this is basically what I'm going to cover in this workshop. I'm going to talk about Stay Housed LA, which is a countywide program that's trying to connect tenants to legal services. I'm going to talk briefly about the eviction process and tenant protections that exist across the state and in Burbank. And I'm going to cover AB 1482, also known as the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, also known as the TPA, which is a statewide tenants' rights act. And then I'm going to discuss the implied warranty of habitability, and then move into fair housing or discrimination in housing. And then I will leave as much time as possible for questions. And again, as Marco said, I just ask that you try to keep questions as general as possible. We're in a public forum. There is no duty of confidentiality here. Anything you say is public information, and typically it's good to keep information like that confidential if you're talking to an attorney. Okay. So for those of you who have never heard of Stay Housed LA, Stay Housed LA is a countywide program to educate tenants on their rights and provide legal assistance to those facing eviction. When I worked as an eviction defense attorney for Neighborhood Legal Services, I was a part of their Stay Housed LA team. And the goal of Stay Housed LA is to keep people in their homes at the end of the day. It turns out in LA County, about 90% of landlords in eviction cases are represented by legal counsel, while only 10% of tenants are represented by legal counsel. So it's a pretty uneven playing field. Stay Housed LA is an attempt to try to even it out a bit. We do this by partnering legal service providers, which are listed up there, like Asian Americans Advancing Justice, BASTA, BETSEDIC, CLA SoCal. I don't need to read off the whole list. It's basically every legal aid firm in the county. And we partner with a lot of local groups like Community for Economic Survival and a bunch of others. If you want the whole list, I definitely recommend checking out the website, which is up there. And we provide a lot of great resources, whether you're a landlord or a tenant. They can be very helpful because there's a lot of information on there, and there are a lot of resources there that basically anybody who is in the housing market can use. As I mentioned, these are the links to the specific spots on the website where you can find other resources. There are workshops that happen every week that are typically hosted by different legal aid firms. Neighborhood Legal Services used to host tenants' rights workshop every Tuesday and Thursday from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. It's not every Tuesday and Thursday anymore, but it's still happening. And then there are some that happen on weekends, some that happen in the evening. So it's as accessible as we can make it. And then also, if you are dealing with an eviction, you can complete the legal aid referral, which will try to connect you to the right legal aid firm that covers your area. And ideally, get you in touch with an attorney who can either represent you or at least give you counsel and advice. I will say right now, as you might imagine, the legal aid firms are swamped. So if you are in the middle of an eviction and you do complete the referral, there's no guarantee that attorney is going to be able to represent you, but they will at least try to reach out and help as much as they can. And then also, if you want to try to handle the issue yourself, there are self-help materials on the website. So there's a toolkit for filing an unlawful detainer answer. There's information for how to complete discovery, and a lot of other good resources I definitely recommend checking out. But that's Stay Housed LA. I'm going to talk about evictions and tenant protections. So for those of you who aren't familiar, an unlawful detainer or an eviction is a process by which the landlord attempts to regain possession of the property from the tenant. It's called an unlawful detainer legally, typically. So if at any point I say unlawful detainer or UD, I just think eviction. It's a legal term, and I know, but they're pretty interchangeable. And the eviction process or unlawful detainers are what are called summary proceedings, because what is primarily at issue is possession of the property. And what a summary proceeding is it's just on a much shorter timeline than a typical civil legal matter. Because unlawful detainers are civil matters, but they are summary proceedings, so they just move much faster. The timeline on a typical civil matter can be years. On unlawful detainer, it's down to months, typically. And also, because it is a summary proceeding, it has its own special section in the California Code of Civil Procedure. So if you ever do want to look up the law as what it says exactly, California Code of Civil Procedure section 1161 is where it starts. And if you just Google CCP 1161, it'll come up. And there are two different types of legal evictions. There's unlawful detainers and forcible detainers. Forcible detainers are exclusively for squatters, essentially, or people who never had a landlord-tenant relationship with the person who's trying to regain possession of the property. I don't handle forcible detainers. I cannot answer any questions about forcible detainers. And most evictions that are filed in Los Angeles County are actually unlawful detainers. And one last thing I'd just like to point out is self-help by landlords is actually illegal. And what that means is if a landlord wants to get a tenant out of the property, they have to go through the eviction process. They cannot call their friends to force you out. They cannot change the locks without going through this process. If they do, it's considered an illegal eviction, and they open themselves up to liability and a civil claim from the tenants. And this is a very, very simplified version of what the legal process looks like for an unlawful detainer. It starts with a notice, which can be a 3-day notice to pay or quit, cure or quit, or a 30 or 60-day notice if it's a no-fault eviction, or a 90-day notice if it's a foreclosure. And once the notice expires and the tenant hasn't moved out or has not abided by the notice, then the landlord can file a complaint with the courts. The court issues a summons. The landlord has to then personally serve, or at least try to personally serve the tenant with the summons and complaint. And once the landlord has served the tenant with the summons and complaint, there are two options. The tenant can refuse to answer or not answer for whatever reason. And if the tenant doesn't file an answer, then there could be a default judgment entered against them. And once a default judgment is entered against a tenant, the court issues what's called a writ of possession. The landlord takes that writ of possession to the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department puts a 5-day notice to vacate on the tenant's door. And if the tenant's still there, after that 5-day notice to vacate expires, the sheriff shows up and essentially forcibly removes the tenant. And the landlord at that point typically changes the locks. I forgot to mention, from the date a tenant is served with the summons and complaint, they have 5 business days to file an answer. So that's 5 days, not counting weekends and holidays. And so essentially a week. It's not a lot of time. So if you ever at some point do find yourself getting served with summons and complaint, seek legal help immediately. Don't ignore it. I have seen that happen way too many times, and tenants end up getting kicked out simply because they received a summons and complaint and didn't really know what to do, or they just couldn't do anything. But in the event that an answer is filed, at that point, it's up to the landlord to request a trial date. And it depends on what's going on. Typically, trial is set for 3 or 4 weeks out. If the courts are really busy, it might be set out a little further, but typically 3 to 4 weeks is kind of the average right now. And once the trial date is set, the court will send out notice in the mail to both parties that says your trial is at this date, at this place, at this time. You show up, and if the case does not settle and the parties decide to go to trial and the tenant loses, then a judgment is issued and the notice to vacate happens and the lockout goes forward. If the tenant wins, then they get to pay all the rent that accrued during the unlawful detainer process and they get to stay. So if you win a trial, you're essentially winning the right to pay rent.
Are the courts cracked up now because of from COVID and all that?
It's less about COVID now and more because there are a lot more evictions happening. During COVID, it was pretty backed up because they couldn't get any kind of juries assembled and they couldn't get anyone to appear in person. Now it's backed up mostly because the eviction moratoriums have ended and a lot of landlords are going forward with evictions they couldn't before.
Can you go back to the previous slide? So for the summons and complaint, so that's when you're essentially served, right?
Yes.
Is there a possibility for the landlord to not serve you? Is there a specific process that they have to follow for serving you?
Yes. So the way it's supposed to happen, you are supposed to be served by a third party that is not a party to the action.
Mm-hmm.
And the landlord is supposed to try to have you personally served with the summons and complaint before they do anything else. If for whatever reason they can't serve you personally, they are allowed to apply for an order to post, which essentially gives them the right to serve you by posting it on your door and mailing you a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's substitute service. And so, yeah, there's a whole process that they have to follow. If they don't do it, then, it's a whole legal matter, and I can't really answer that without getting into specifics. These are a couple examples of notices to quit or notices to pay or quit. It's very important. If you're a landlord, it is very important to do this right, because there are some very specific rules about what a notice has to include, depending on what type of notice it is, and also how it has to be served. It has to be a physical paper, and it has to include a bunch of language. A text, an email don't count. If your landlord sends you an email that says you got 3 days to get out, that's not valid notice. It has to be something like this. I'm going to go back to CCP 1161 really quick because it is kind of important. It is kind of the basis of the procedure of an eviction. Because it does lay out essentially the 7 reasons for terminating a tenancy. 1161.1 declare is about expiration of the lease. If the lease expires and there's been no extension and the landlord hasn't been accepting rent and the tenant stays anyway, then that's grounds for eviction. 1161.2, non-payment of rent, kind of goes without saying. The landlord can serve a 3-day notice to pay or quit, from which point the tenant can either leave or pay the rent. 1161.3 is a breach of the term of the lease, in which case the landlord has to serve a 3-day notice to perform or quit and give the tenant an opportunity to cure or perform the lease. And then 1161.4 is for nuisance or unlawful use of the premises. And in this case, the distinction here is that under 1161.4, the landlord doesn't have to give the tenant 3 days to cure the problem. And so the distinction is typically in terms of degrees. If a landlord finds out that the tenant has been dealing drugs out of their unit, they don't have to give them an opportunity to cure that problem. They can just say, you need to get out. But if there's a breach of the lease, like if they have a pet that isn't in the lease or they're making noise or something like that, then the landlord does have to give them 3 days to fix the problem before they can go forward with an eviction. And then 1161.5, is if the tenant surrenders the lease, which tenants can do, tenants can move out on their own. And then 1161A deals exclusively with mobile homes. I don't know a lot about mobile home evictions, but there is an entire section of the law devoted to mobile home evictions. I'm sorry if you have questions about that, I won't really be able to answer them. And then 1161B is after foreclosure, as I mentioned. It's one of the few instances where tenants are supposed to get 90 days notice. So affirmative defenses. Now, what if you didn't, you know, a tenant didn't pay the rent, but they had a very good reason? That's essentially what an affirmative defense is. It's a defense against eviction that a tenant can apply in an unlawful detainer action, either at trial or in a prejudgment motion. Because there are legal reasons for why a tenant isn't paying rent, or why they breached the lease, or why a landlord can't evict for certain reasons. And the common affirmative defenses are listed up there. Those are the ones we typically see a lot of: waiver, estoppel, defective notice, breach of warranty of habitability, retaliation, and discrimination. The last defective notice I already mentioned is if a notice is defective, that can be that can make the entire unlawful detainer invalid. So it's important to make sure the notice is valid. Waiver and estoppel are, if you're not in law school, the distinction is kind of hard to explain, but essentially it is if the landlord's actions in some way waive or in any way undermine the reason for the eviction. So if a landlord serves a tenant with a notice to quit for whatever reason, and then after the notice expires, accepts rent from the tenant, that's typically considered a waiver of the notice to quit, because a landlord cannot try to evict and accept rent at the same time. Estoppel is more about actions that lull the tenant into a false sense of security. So if a tenant was breaching the lease, but the landlord said over and over, oh, it's not a big deal, don't worry about it, I'm not gonna evict you for it, and then tries to go forward with an eviction for that reason, that would be an estoppel argument. Breach of warranty, if the last three I'm going to talk about in much more detail later in this presentation. And one thing to keep in mind, affirmative defenses, they have to be listed in the answer to be applied at trial. This photo on the right here is part of the UD answer. It's the official answer form that you have to file with the court. There's a box next to each affirmative defense. You have to check that box if you want that affirmative defense to apply in your case. If you don't, then you might get to trial. And even if you have a great waiver argument, if you didn't check the box that says you have a waiver argument, you might not be able to make that argument at court. And I will say I have never once seen a tenant get in trouble for checking a box when that argument didn't apply, but you are signing this under penalty of perjury, so you better have a good reason for why you thought it should. And also I will say, if you ever do want to get like a very thorough rundown of what any affirmative defenses might be, just look up the answer and read it, because all of them are there. It takes a long time to read them all. Okay. I'm going to step away from evictions just for a second and talk about the right of entry and voidable lease terms. The landlord does have a right of entry to a unit, but it is not unlimited. A landlord may enter in an emergency. If there's a fire, if someone's dying, then a landlord can get in without any kind of notice. However, if the landlord wants to enter to make necessary repairs, or they want to show the apartment to a potential buyer, something like that, the notice is required. The landlord has to give notice to the tenant that they're going to enter the unit, and it has to be reasonable written notice. And reasonable is a very vague term. Lawyers love to use it, but generally 24 hours advance notice is deemed to be reasonable. And it does have to be in writing, it has to be posted, and it has to be served properly. The written notice has to describe the reason for entry. And yeah, it has to be a valid reason for entry. It can't just be because I want to. And it also does have to be during normal business hours. The landlord can't say, I'm going to enter your unit at 11 p.m. to do an inspection. It has to be. Yeah.
Does taping to the door count as delivery?
Yeah. That typically does, yeah. There are lease terms that are void as against public policy. Now, what that means is that even if these terms are included in the lease that you signed, it doesn't matter because they are void and they're against public policy. So you can't waive if you're a tenant, you can't waive your right regarding your security deposit or the landlord's right of entry. You can't waive your right to sue for future claims. You can't waive your right to a notice or hearing required by law. Even if your lease says the landlord can evict me for whatever reason at any time without going through the eviction process, no, they can't. And typically that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen a lot. A lot of leases are pretty boilerplate and written by lawyers. So they don't typically include terms like this, but I've seen some handwritten leases that are definitely not enforceable. So it's good to keep in mind. So I'm going to talk about just public housing and subsidized housing really quickly, just to point out that there are different rules if you are living in subsidized housing or if you are a Section 8 tenant or you're in public housing, because not all the rules are different if you are government, if you have government funding or you're living in government subsidized housing. And the rules of subsidized housing are way more complex than I can go into tonight. And it really depends on what kind of housing development or, you know, what kind of subsidized housing you're doing. So I just wanted to point out that if you are in or if you are receiving subsidized housing or anything like that, you want to check either with either your caseworker or the government agency that handles that housing development, because the rules could be entirely different. And speaking of rules that are different, AB 1482, the Tenant Protection Act of 2019. So what the TPA is a California statewide just cause protections and rent control law. So what this means is that if the TPA applies to your tenancy, the landlord has to show a just cause to terminate the tenancy. And if you ever want to look up the TPA in the civil code, it's civil code 1946.2. And also it is a statewide rent control law. So landlords are limited in how much they can raise rent annually. It is the maximum amount is 5% plus the percentage change in the consumer price index or 10%, whichever is lower. I think right now it's
8.7.
Yeah, so 8.8. So yeah, the total would be 8.7 or 8.8. And it'll change next year when the CPI changes. Now, adding on extra fees and costs could be considered a rent increase if it's done on top of the maximum increase allowed under the TPA. I've heard issues, especially in Burbank, that some landlords have started charging tenants for common area utilities. Whether or not that's an illegal rent increase under the Tenant Protection Act, I can't say for certain because it hasn't been tried in court yet. But if this is happening to you, it might be a good idea to consult with an attorney and see what they say. But I can't say whether one way or another whether or not that's true. And the TPA does apply basically to any property with two or more rental units, not including the owner's unit, built within the last 15 years. And so basically any multifamily development is covered by the TPA in the state of California. Now, there are exceptions, and the list of exceptions is long and kind of confusing at times, but single family homes owned by an individual or owner occupied are typically exempt, and dormitories for schools or certain affordable housing is also exempt. So these are the just cause protections in the Tenant Protection Act. They're split into two categories. There's at fault just causes and no fault just causes. At fault just causes, you might imagine, is a just cause that the tenant caused. If the tenant does something wrong, then that is an at fault just cause for eviction. So those are all the reasons why a landlord can evict under the Tenant Protection Act: on payment, breach of the lease, nuisance, committing waste, refusal to execute an extension of an expired lease, criminal activity, improper subletting, refusal to allow proper entry. These are all reasons for evictions under the Tenant Protection Act. No fault just causes are the exact opposite. The landlord wants to evict, not because of anything the tenant did, but because they just want the tenant out. And there are only specific reasons for why they want the tenant out that they can evict that tenant under the TPA. So for example, if they want to occupy the unit themselves or one of their immediate family members, that's a no fault just cause for eviction. If they're planning on withdrawing the property from the rental market, or if they were ordered by the government to evict, which happens a lot of times in cases of extreme dilapidation of properties, or if they want to demolish or substantially remodel the premises. And there are relocations.
On that last one you said, I understand that a fair amount of cases now, the landlord is taking advantage of that to demolish or substantial remodel item.
Yes.
What do you have to say on that?
I have two things to say about that. One is that the city of Burbank actually passed an emergency ordinance regarding that, and that's the next slide, which I'll talk about. And then also, yes, so this just this past weekend, Governor Newsom signed SB 567, which does kind of tighten the restrictions on some of these no-fault just causes. It also allows for a private right of action. It essentially amends the Tenant Protection Act to tighten the protections a little bit. And it also allows for a private and public right of action against landlords who do illegal rent increases. But that doesn't take effect until April 1st, 2024. So that's why I didn't talk about it here, because right now it's not the law, but it will be come April.
I just want to follow up, because this is a big problem we have in the local. So in our cases, we know, because I've experienced in the past, we know that those remodeling are not substantial. I have proof because they needed flooring, in like 6-7 hours, and they redid the kitchen the other day, it was just 6-7 hours. So I was in a meeting with the LA County, one of the lawyers was saying that we should fight it, but in 5-6-7, it makes a difference between cosmetic and structural. That's definitely cosmetic, but like, since it's not going to be effective for April 2024, what protections do we have? Can we prove from the jury and all that stuff?
Yes, so I'm going to talk about the Burbank Emergency Ordinance because that does address this matter. But if a landlord is evicting for a no-fault just cause, they still have to prove that just cause at court. If you take the case to trial, they have to show that they are planning on substantially remodeling and that it is a substantial remodel. And typically a substantial remodel means that the tenant can't live in that unit for at least 30 days. So if they want to go to trial, I mean, you can contest that at trial. You can say, this isn't substantial. This is only going to take a week. This isn't a valid reason to evict. This isn't a valid no fault just cause. Whether or not you take that to trial is up to you. I always tell tenants, trials are risky. You never know who's going to win. And this is why 95% of these cases end up settling one way or another, because trials are risky for both parties. But yes, you are well within your rights to take it to trial and argue that they're not actually substantially remodeling the place. They're just lying about it.
We had somebody's one bedroom that was remodeled, whatever, in 3 weeks in the same apartment complex. So we have that proof as well. So
I could talk to you after this. Yeah. I want to get through the presentation because this is getting very specific, and I want to see if I can help a little bit more. But while I've got everybody, I'll get through the presentation. We'll talk after. And the Tenant Protection Act does require relocation assistance. It's not a lot. It's 1 month's rent, essentially. The landlord has to either pay the tenant 1 month's rent or just waive the last month's rent if they're going to go through a no-fault eviction. And if they don't do that, that can be grounds for – that is an affirmative defense in court. So if they don't do that, you can say this is an invalid, unlawful detainer because they never gave me my relocation assistance. And as I promised, the Burbank Urgency Tenant Protection Ordinance, which was just passed last month, became effective as soon as it was passed. And what it did was it heightened the no-fault just cause protection. There are extra requirements for evictions based on intent to demolish or substantially remodel the property. So those extra protections include the permits have to have been secured for the remodel or the demolition. The tenants have to have been provided with the permits. And the tenant has to have been provided with an account of the scope of work, why they need to move, and why it will take more than 30 days. So this is going to your question. These are the protections that the city of Burbank has enacted for demolishing or substantially remodeling. If they don't do any of these, the unlawful detainer is invalid. And you would apply that as an affirmative defense in court.
They have to give you 3 months instead of like 2 days.
That is my next point, yes. So the heightened real, if they do go forward with a no-fault eviction based on substantial remodel or demolition, now in the city of Burbank, landlords are required to give 3 months relocation assistance instead of just the one under the tenant protection.
Oh, does that mean instead of 60-day notice, you get a 90-day notice?
No. As far as I'm aware, the notice period hasn't changed at all. The city of Burbank did essentially adopt the Tenant Protection Act, and these are the only two things they really changed about it. Everything else is still the same. The 60-day notice period is still the same. It's 3 months of your rent.
Okay, so that's 4 months.
Yes. Yes, in the city of Burbank alone. Okay. So we're kind of done with evictions, but they'll keep coming up as they often do. But we're going to move into the implied warranty of habitability. If you don't know what the implied warranty of habitability, it is essentially a law that states that a landlord has a duty to maintain the leased premises so that they are fit for human habitation. This warranty is implied. So regardless of what the lease or rental agreement says, the landlord has to maintain the unit. And the warranty cannot be waived explicitly or implicitly. So even if there's an issue with the unit that the landlord's aware of and the tenant stays, the landlord still has to fix the problem. They don't waive the implied warranty of habitability by sticking around, even though the unit's uninhabitable. And the breach of a warranty could be a defense to eviction. Kind of depends on what you're being evicted for, but it typically only applies in non-payment of rent cases, which I'll go into. So you might be asking, what does habitability mean? It is a bit of a flexible term. You know, the dictionary just describes it as capable of being lived in or sustainable for habitation, which is very gray and doesn't really make anything clear. But fortunately, there are specifics in the law, particularly in the civil code and the health and safety code, that do list off conditions of units that do typically mean that a unit is uninhabitable. And this picture is also from the answer that you can file in an unlawful detainer action. It lists, basically, if you want to apply the habitability defense, you check the box and then check off any parts of those that apply in your case. So mold, infestations, faulty wiring, broken smoke detectors. There are a bunch of ways in which a unit could be deemed uninhabitable. And I will say, typically, if like two or three of these are checked off, and it's bad, and each one of those is bad enough, that can typically mean the unit is uninhabitable. And there are ways to deal with that if you are dealing with an uninhabitable unit, but there's no eviction. So what are your options if any of those conditions do exist? The first thing you got to do is inform the landlord. You can't enforce this warranty if the landlord is unaware of these units as they exist. Of these conditions if they exist in your unit. And if the landlord is informed of the problem and they are given a reasonable time to fix the problem, but they don't, then the tenant has options. There's something called repair and deduct, which is the tenant fixes the problem themselves and deducts the cost of fixing it from the rent. Or they can let the landlord know that they're going to withhold rent until the problem is fixed. And then if the landlord tries to evict for non-payment, then they apply the warranty of habitability as an affirmative defense to eviction. And you can also try reporting it to a government agency. There are government agencies that do handle habitability issues specifically. I will go through what those agencies are near the end of the presentation. And then also you can move out. There's something called constructive eviction. If you're in 6 months of a one-year term lease, you can make the argument of what's called constructive eviction, essentially saying the landlord evicted you everything but legally. And so you're not, they breached their side of the lease, so they're not entitled to the rent remaining in the lease. You can also file a lawsuit against the landlord if the conditions are bad enough and there's actual damages, or your health and safety has been seriously impacted. That can be enough to file a civil claim against the landlord. But again, you do have to show some kind of damages typically, and you do have to show that the landlord was aware of the problem, but didn't fix it. And if you're afraid to let the landlord know, because you know some landlords don't really want to be told that anything's wrong with the unit, they just want to collect rent, there is something called a retaliatory eviction. And landlords cannot retaliate against tenants who report unsafe or illegal conditions. So any attempts to evict a tenant within 180 days of the tenant reporting conditions to landlord or the government is presumed to be retaliatory. That doesn't mean the eviction is retaliatory. It just means that the landlord has to prove that it wasn't, on top of proving that it was actually for the reason the landlord is claiming. Go over fair housing really quickly. So I'm pleased to report that in the state of California, discrimination is illegal against private parties. There are several state laws, such as the UNRU Civil Rights Act, Fair Employment and Housing Act, and the Fair Housing Act is a federal law that applies here. Because there are different laws at different levels. There are holes in each one of them, but typically when taken together, they cover just about everything. So as it says up there, you know, the Fair Employment and Housing Act and the Fair Housing Acts do not apply to certain homes occupied by owners with less than a certain number of units, but the UNRU Civil Rights Act applies to every landlord. So, you know, they really do try to cover all the bases with this. And there are also rules and laws that prohibit discrimination in government programs. So government code 11135 is California, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is a federal, and then Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 is also federal. And then there is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which specifically handles disabilities, and which I'm going to talk about a little bit in a second, because there are certain, because disability accommodations are also one of your rights as a tenant. And so this is from the UNRU Civil Rights Act. This essentially lists off every protected class of person in the state of California. So sex, race, color, religion, ancestry, national origin, disability, medical condition, genetic information, marital status, sexual orientation, citizenship, primary language, or immigration status. You cannot discriminate on any of these. No landlord can. This is the basic civil rights law of the state. This covers every landlord in the state. And discrimination is a pretty broad term. It can encompass anything from harassment to reduction in services to refusing to rent to a certain person because they are in a protected class. And this is from the Fair Employment and Housing Act. I bring this up specifically because, as I said, there are holes in all of them, and that some of them cover for each other. The Fair Employment and Housing Act adds a couple other protected classes, such as gender identity, gender expression, and source of income. So landlords cannot, under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, landlords cannot discriminate based on those as well. Now, source of income discrimination is It's a bit of a special category because in a lot of these other cases, a landlord is not allowed to inquire as to like what your gender identity is or what your race is or color or any of that. But the landlord can inquire as to what your source of income is. And this typically comes up with Section 8 tenants because a lot of landlords think, you know, or they don't want Section 8 tenants, or they have certain ideas or stereotypes about Section 8 tenants. And so they try to avoid renting to them, but that is, under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, that is illegal. They can't refuse to accept a tenant based on source of income, but they are legally allowed to inquire as to what it is. And that on the right there is a list of anything that a list of things that discrimination can entail. As I mentioned, harassment, you know, inferior terms or services, segregated housing, all of this is illegal under a California civil rights law. So as I mentioned, I'm going to talk more briefly about disability discrimination, because under the ADA and under California civil rights laws, landlords are required to make what's called reasonable accommodations to tenants with disabilities, so long as they do not create an undue burden on the landlord. And a disability can be physical or mental. It could be anything that substantially limits a person's major life activities. And again, discrimination can be a defense to eviction. If you can show the landlord is discriminating against you, that can be enough to show that the eviction is invalid. And what a reasonable accommodation could be, just to give you some examples, because it's not always clear, but like if a tenant is on Social Security disability and they receive their checks on the third of the month, and the lease demands that the rent be paid on the first, you can ask for a reasonable accommodation to allow the rent to be paid just a little bit later. That would typically be a reasonable accommodation that the landlord has to grant. And government agencies. So that's not showing up very well. It's supposed to be blue, but this is a list of government agencies that do handle housing enforcement or enforcement of certain laws. If you're dealing with health issues, mold, infestations, I really recommend calling the Department of Public Health. Especially when it comes to mold, they can be pretty intense. And I really appreciate them for that, because the LA Housing Department is kind of toothless, but that they don't have jurisdiction in the city of Burbank. And if you think you're dealing with discrimination, or you know someone who is, the California Civil Rights Department will do investigations into discrimination based on housing and employment. And again, they are also pretty on the ball. Now, if you're a Section 8 tenant or you're in public housing in the city of Burbank, the Burbank Housing Authority does handle that. And the Housing and Urban Development Department basically handles all of Section 8. So if you are a Section 8 tenant, those are the two to call. And I've never called the Environmental Protection Agency, but they do have a lead safe repair program. So if your unit has lead in it, they do have a program to try to get rid of it, make sure you're not dealing with any health issues. Yeah.
Is there a way like to do a home test to see if you have lead pipes?
Yeah. Well,
so that pipes is paint.
Yeah, it's typically paint. Pipes can be an issue, but it's more in paint, because the paint starts flecking off and there's lead in those paint flecks and kids eat it and lead poisoning happens. My understanding is that there are home tests you can get to test if there's lead in the paint or anywhere. But I've never done that before. I've never had a client or dealt with a tenant who did go through all that, so I can't really give you any specifics on that. Okay. Well, thank you all for listening. I appreciate it. If you do have any general questions, I'm happy to answer them for like another hour and 15 minutes. I'm here. Yeah.
So both AB 1482 and 567, actually, they have quite the amount of exemptions. What's the history behind those?
So the exceptions are, I mean, do you want me to go into the politics of it? Because
yeah,
I mean,
actually,
it's kind of, it's how the sausage is made, really.
Yeah.
Cause like, for example, dormitories, you know, schools need to be able to get students out of dormitories, and the teachers' unions and the university system are massive and they lobby heavily. And single family homes, there are a lot of homeowners who make a lot of donations and lobby very heavily. I mean, it's really just a way to make sure that renters are protected, but also making sure that, you know, certain property owners don't have to jump through all these hoops to get people out. Again, I wasn't around in 20, I wasn't there in 2019. I wasn't in, or I was in Sacramento in 2019, but I wasn't in the Capitol in 2019. So I can't really say for certain all the lobbying that happened there, but on the whole, it's a great law, in my opinion, but it really is mostly for protecting folks living in multifamily housing.
So what's the kind of
I have bigger slides as well.
Oh. Yeah, they came more prepared than I did, so they should have everything.
Thank you for the great presentation. Can you provide more information about a defective notice?
Yeah, so the defective notice is basically any, if the notice to quit of any kind is defective in any way in that it doesn't abide by the letter of the law for whatever reason, then the notice is defective. And it can be defective for any number of reasons. And for example, if it gives you, if it's a 3-day notice to quit instead of, it should have been a cure quit, that could be a defect in the notice. If the notice overstates the amount of rent owed, that can be a defect in the notice. If it doesn't include language about picking up abandoned property, that could be a defect in the notice. And it really depends on the rule. And I'm thinking, I work more in Los Angeles, which also has kind of tighter restrictions on what a notice is supposed to include now. But it really, as long as the notice doesn't abide by even one letter of the law, then that could be deemed enough to get an eviction dismissed.
The notice doesn't include the new ordinance of 3 months instead of 1 month, that's defective.
If the notice is in Burbank and the notice says that the tenant isn't in its and it's a no-fault eviction specifically for demolition or substantial remodel, and the notice says you're entitled to 1 month's rent instead of three, that could be a defect, yeah. But I will point out too, the emergency ordinance passed September 12th. So if the notice was served before that, I don't know. You'll have to seek further legal counsel for that.
But definitely if it was served after.
Yes.
So following on what they said about the 1 month, so if the notice was sent on September 30th, so it was after the ordinance passed.
Yeah.
So then technically that's no valid. So then the landlord, can they send you a second one with those corrections once they find out what they missed or what they didn't do correctly?
Yes, they can. I mean, a landlord can always serve you another notice. A second notice served is typically a waiver of the first one. So they can't serve you one that's like, oh, you now have 56 days to move out instead of 60. It has to be a 60-day notice again.
The process starts over, essentially.
Yeah. The notice period starts over.
It starts over, like, on a monthly basis, or is it, like, so, like, today is what?
No, it's the notice period. It's the notice period starts when the notice is served.
Okay.
So if you were served with a 60-day notice today, it would be 60 days from today.
Okay. And so, back to kind of like what I was talking about earlier, you said you might want to help. I don't know if that's the right time. But like 5, 6, 7, this part for structural versus cosmetic is really clearly, you know, I did some back of the envelope calculation, you know, just quickly. Like if my rent is at $1,000 in 2020, if I have about 10% increase for 3 years, I should be about $1,331. So now what we found is that they want to charge $2,000. So that's 50% increase. That's not justifiable, right? And then we know also that those changes they're making can be done in less than 30 days because of previous experiences, and we have a specific example.
So
what do we do about this? How can we fight that? Like, what's the next steps for?
So the landlord can reset the rent if they get the tenant out. And this is under the Costa-Hawkins Act, which deals with rent control. But if a landlord gets every original tenant out of a unit, they can set the rent of any new tenants to whatever they want. They don't have to abide by the rent increase or the rent control. So that's why a lot of landlords are, you know, especially now the housing market is insane as it is, they're pretty desperate to get tenants out because they want to jack up the rent by God knows how much. So if they get you out, they can charge the next tenant as much as they want, or as much as the tenant's willing to pay, I should say.
And in the, how can we fight this? Like, you know, showing cosmetic versus structural, 30 days.
You're going into legal strategy there, and that really deals kind of with your specific case. I would just say, you know, you can go through the discovery process. Like if you go through the case, you go through the discovery process, you can request documents. You can request admissions. You can depose the landlord. You know, you can go through the whole evidence gathering process to try to get your case together to prove that they're not actually substantially remodeling. Whether or not the evidence exists, I don't know. That's entirely dependent on your case and the landlord.
Thank you for the presentation, Henry. I do appreciate it. Also, thank you for the Burbank staff for allowing the workshop to happen. So the opportunity for us all to be here. The question that I have is regarding evictions. And you mentioned that in a moment, was it you conflated that and equaled it to a UD, an unlawful detainer.
Yeah.
I know what a UD is. And what I'm not sure that I think some people who are asking questions about what is their recourse is being able to argue if the eviction proceedings have begun.
Yeah,
and that's when you start checking the boxes that you mentioned in your earlier slides, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That means that the eviction process has been noticed. They've been served to say, here are your 360s,
yeah,
whatever the notices are. And now it's kind of in the court system.
No.
So it's only in the court system once the landlord files the complaint with the court. And that can only happen after the notice expires. I mean, it can happen before the notice expires, but if the landlord files a complaint before the notice expires, then that's also a defect in the complaint, and that's also a defect.
But in the meantime, you also mentioned in reference, and thank you for that, is that typically a tenant is not represented by counsel.
Yes.
And that the reason why that is, and I'd like to clarify this, is because landlords are typically required to retain counsel to file evictions.
No. Well, in certain instances, they are. However, if it's an individual landlord, they can do it themselves. I've dealt with landlords who represent themselves. Personally, I prefer dealing with attorneys just because attorneys
sure
know the law. But no, landlords, if it's an individual landlord, they can do it themselves. If it's a corporate landlord, they are required to obtain counsel. But individual landlords, if it's just them who own the property, they can do it themselves.
Can you also, I guess my reason for making this one comment is, unlawful detainers are, if the risk, you mentioned risk in your comments,
mm-hmm,
the risk to a tenant to lose the portrait and have an unlawful detainer recorded against them is very significant.
Yes.
Do you have any experience of the severity of recorded UV? And
yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, well, actually, thank you for bringing it up. That's a good point. What I tell tenants, what I've told clients, is that the worst case scenario in an eviction for them is to go to trial and lose. Because if they go to trial and lose, there's going to be a lockout in typically 2-3 weeks. They typically get a money judgment against them for any of the rent that was due at the time the judgment was entered. And also they get an eviction on their record, because evictions or court records in general are public information. And there are firms that gather information about tenants and about eviction judgments and open them up to landlords who are interested in determining whether or not a tenant's ever been evicted. It's essentially a blacklist. And so a lot of tenants, once they get an eviction on their record, getting a new place is almost impossible. And that's why a lot of these cases end up settling. Like 90 to 95% of them end up settling. And one of the terms that is, in my experience, always included in a settlement is the record is sealed, so that there is no judgment on the tenant's record and it's private information, it's confidential information, and it's never released to the public. So that way the tenant can hopefully find a new place and move out and avoid getting a judgment on the record. If you do get a judgment on your record, it's supposed to only last for 7 years. But I will say I think once ran into a landlord that was upset about the idea of sealing the record for a tenant, because it doesn't cost the landlord anything. They just have to be like, yeah, we stipulate to that. That's fine. But yeah, it can, an eviction on the record is pretty devastating in my experience and my understanding.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is if the case is settled out of court, so you can ask for the record to be sealed. Can a judgment be sealed?
Yes. So if you go to trial and lose, It is still possible for both parties to stipulate to sealing the record. I don't think I've ever seen a landlord agree to seal a record after winning a trial. That's typically not something they care to do, especially after they just spent however much money on paying their attorneys to go through the trial. There is a way to seal a record after the fact. You can file what's called a motion to seal. They're not easy to get past though, because the courts are allowed to seal records at their discretion, but it is kind of against public policy for them to do so. It's considered good public policy for these court records to be public information. So you kind of have to, I've only done this, I think, twice before. You have to make the argument that public policy is not impacted, or you're not impacting the public's right to know by sealing this particular person's eviction judgment. And also, I will say, if you do get it sealed after the fact, all of these firms that collect information about tenants and about eviction judgments, they still have that information up. And the only way to get it taken down is to basically go to each one with an order from the court saying the record is sealed, you have to take this down. It's not public information anymore. So even if you do get it sealed after the fact, that's not necessarily going to prevent a landlord from finding out that you were actually evicted at some point.
When do you actually ask to be sealed? Like if you want to go to the trial, like?
If you want to go to trial, then honestly, I mean, you shouldn't count on the record getting sealed.
Only if you settle.
Yeah, if you... You can settle a case at any point before trial, any point before judgment. I've seen cases that settled in the middle of trial. But you can settle a case at any point before judgment is entered. And if you settle a case, then typically one of the terms that are included is sealing the record. That's something both parties can agree to.
Oh, but not if you keep fighting.
No, if you go to trial and lose, then if you go to trial and lose, you can still stipulate to sealing the record, but the landlord who just beat you at trial has to agree to it. And that's unlikely. They're not that merciful typically, especially after going through trial.
So yeah, I mean, just kind of following up on that, you mentioned that like getting an eviction on your record is pretty detrimental. I mean, like you said, like after that it's pretty hard to come back from that or get another place. But if the landlord loses, is there something equivalent as detrimental as that?
Oh, no. 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 The landlord gets to collect the rent that they weren't allowed to collect while the eviction was ongoing, and they have to let you stay. It's essentially it. I mean, the detriment to the landlord is they have to keep dealing with this tenant that they just tried to evict.
Right, but there's like no penalty, like no. It doesn't go on a public record, so I'm with it, like, you know. It's
no. I imagine if we were in a different position in which housing wasn't in such short supply and tenants could pick and choose which landlords they were renting from, that might make a difference. But seeing as housing supply is low, landlords can kind of pick and choose tenants instead of the other way around. So, yeah.
Anyway, I think I asked my question. Thank you.
whatever would come out of the judgment or the decision would be not derogatory to the tenant.
Sorry?
Would not be derogatory to the tenant.
So yeah.
Even if these places picked it up, publishing it, landlord said, well, tenant was right. The other landlord was wrong.
But there's a lot of landlords that unfortunately, you know, will look at, you know, information for a specific tenant, and you know, because there's so many people looking for housing, you know, just use that as a way to kind of weed out.
And in the first place, these agencies wouldn't collect and file that information. I think it's their benefit.
The thing is that it's the landlord is kind of the one with all the power in terms of providing housing or in terms of making sure the tenant is housed. And for a lot of tenants, you know, particularly tenants who are unrepresented, it's, you know, either fighting for where they are or getting a good deal or ending up homeless at this point. And
right. If
they go to trial and lose and they get a judgment on their record, then the odds of them becoming homeless just jump astronomically. And I have yet to see a landlord suffer any kind of detriment as significant as that.
Right. So I mean, like, that's kind of what I was pointing out. Like, if you get that eviction on your record, like, it's going to be very difficult for you to get another apartment unless you were to, like, let's just say that you're fortunate to have family and you can move in with family. Let's just say that you're fortunate and you can have family within the state or within your own city.
Yeah.
But if you're not, you know, like, the detrimental, like the uphillness of having to go to court and risking that, like, risking where to live and not ending up on the street for the next, you said 7 years?
7 years. And yeah, and that's just the housing market right now. That's the situation that LA is in. And a lot of cities are in. It's just kind of, I'm not allowed to advocate for policy while I'm working, while I'm on the clock. So I'll stop talking right now before
your bias is already showing.
Oh, I'm allowed to be biased. I'm supposed to be biased. I just can't, I can't argue for policy or policy changes.
Can you walk us through the process? So you said if there were two or three serious health violations, that's a serious issue that you could use to fight against an eviction. But if you just had those instances, or even one serious health code instance, and you brought it to the attention to the landlord and they're not following through, what's the process to get that rectified for the tenant?
Yeah, you don't have to wait until there are three problems. One problem is enough. If there's just mold or there's just an infestation, you can let the landlord know. In which case you have all those options I mentioned, repair and deduct, you know, withholding rent, letting a government agent know. You don't have to, I typically say, the thing is if you apply warranty of habitability defense, if you apply it as an affirmative defense in eviction, the problem kind of needs to be significant enough to show that the unit was genuinely uninhabitable, that it was seriously impacting your health and safety. If it was just, you know, I saw a couple roaches the other day and that was it, it's not a very strong defense to not paying your rent. But if it's, there was a roach nest behind the refrigerator and in the walls, and the landlord refused to do anything about that, that's a different story.
You need to give the landlord a reasonable time to cure it.
Yes, that's true. You do have to give the landlord a reasonable time to fix the problem. Again, reasonable comes up a lot because it's very flexible. But you know, a couple weeks, I would say, is probably reasonable. And if they don't, then yeah, you can do what I said. And if you do think I'm going to go forward with repairing the problem myself and deducting the rent, or I'm going to withhold rent, tell the landlord that's what you're going to do, because what I've seen typically is that as soon as a tenant says they're going to stop paying rent, the landlord jumps. And it's, you know, it's not real to them until they're not collecting rent money.
Is there risk of retaliation in case the tenant does repair themselves and are not up to the standards of the landlord?
I mean, there's always a risk of retaliation. You never know when what a landlord's going to take personally and try to evict a tenant for it. I've met landlords that really take the title literally, and don't really have any kind of concerns about tenants' rights. Yeah, I'm not saying all of them. You know, I just want to point that out, but I've seen the worst of it. So. It really depends on the landlord, it depends on the situation. And this is also why a lot of cases settle and why a lot of tenants end up moving. Because as soon as a landlord's filed an eviction against a tenant, that's kind of the end of any amicable relationship between
right.
the two.
So, I mean, like, because it kind of goes back with, like, you know, you said, like, the word reasonable comes up a lot. So, like, yeah, let's just go with something simple, like the plumbing kind of backs up. You call the landlord and says, like, I'm trying to get the plumber on the phone, but, you know, everything's busy because it just rained or whatever.
Yeah.
So then the tenant decides, like, you know what, it's been a couple of weeks, I'm going to try to do it myself.
Yeah.
And let's just say that it doesn't go well as planned. It's a, you know, like what happens there?
The landlord is not obligated to fix problems you cause.
Okay.
You are liable for damage you cause to the property. So typically letting the professionals handle it is a better idea than trying to fix it yourself.
You're a licensed contractor.
I mean,
yeah. No, this is, so yeah, the warranty of habitability really only applies to issues you didn't cause. If you broke a window, you can't then say the landlord's responsible for fixing it. You got to do it.
Right.
And if you don't, then that could potentially be grounds for eviction.
Mm-hmm.
because typically every lease includes some term about how your tenant's responsible for maintaining the property.
Even if you were to say, like, well, I try to get a hold of them, but, like, you know, it's a couple of weeks or a month went by.
I mean, if the landlord's just not responding, then
not really.
Yeah, that could be an issue. But I mean,
Two months.
Yeah. Well,
if you break a window, the landlord repairs it, you can charge for
that. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, and we're getting into the weeds of the facts now,
right.
So it's not so general
love
anymore.
Weeds.
Love the weeds.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where I work.
Wow.
So how often do you, how likely is it for a tenant to win against the landlord? And if that's not the case, but, you know, it's not very low, what's the average settlement? That's two questions.
So I can't really tell you how often tenants win. It's not, if they're not represented, it's not often. Last I saw, there was a study done that was like, if a tenant is represented by counsel, there's something like 3 times more likely to have a favorable outcome than if they're not. As to what a good settlement is, depends entirely on the case. Yeah, because it depends entirely on how strong your case is. Because I've seen, and also it kind of depends on what the landlord's willing to give you. I've seen cases that I thought were really strong that a tenant just kind of wanted to accept whatever the landlord was willing to give them. I've seen cases that were pretty weak where the landlord was like, I'll give you 6 months to move out and I'll waive all the rent. That was during COVID though. So that was a little different situation. And that's kind of my practice mostly when all the COVID protections were in effect. And that really changed the equation for a lot of landlord-tenant relationships.
Well, I just give you an example. Somebody got $15,000 what we need. So I'm just, that's the number here.
Well,
you know.
That's up to the landlord. I mean,
yeah.
I tell tenants if they're willing to leave, they can ask to be paid. Because the thing is too, is lawyers cost money. And how much money it costs the landlord to get you out might be as much as they're willing to pay you just to get out, to agree to leave. Now, if you do agree to leave and you write a signed statement saying that you're going to leave on this date, then you better be out by that date, because that on its own is grounds to kick you out. But I will say, I mentioned earlier, the worst case scenario for tenants is going to trial and losing. What I started telling tenants was the second worst case scenario is signing an agreement saying you're going to be out by a certain date and not getting out by that date, because especially if it's court stipulation, the landlord does not have to go back to court. They can go forward with a lockout the day after you agreed to leave. So, and I unfortunately had several clients who agreed to leave at a certain date, could not find a place to go, and ended up getting locked out anyway. So that's something to bear in mind.
What if you're dealing with a corporate company, with a corporate rental company, where it's just very difficult to like either get a hold of the landlord itself? Like, what are the paths there?
So property management companies are legal agents of the landlord. So whatever they do is typically the landlord is also liable for. And if the landlord has hired a property management company to handle any property management issues and the property manager is not responding, that's on the landlord, or that's, you know, there's no real legal difference there. There's just a degree of separation.
Can you spend a little bit more time talking about legal agents? I think that's important though, that everybody here understands.
Oh man, okay.
So before you go, after that question, I have a few people on Zoom that want to ask a question.
We've been jabbing. Sorry about
it's
that.
After that, I will get to their question.
I got to remember my business associations class. So legal agents are, it's a legal term in which basically if a landlord or any business or any person hires someone to do a job and act on their behalf, that person is a legal agent. And anything that they do in the course of acting in their responsibilities as an agent can be attributed to the person who hired them to be an agent. So property management companies are typically agents of landlords to manage the property. And so in that case, if the property management company is not doing anything they're supposed to under the lease, then the landlord isn't doing what they're supposed to under the lease. Now you can try to elevate the problem. You can try to go directly to the landlord. In fact, I kind of recommend it. And I haven't said this yet, and I've been remiss, but get everything in writing, whether or not you're a tenant or a landlord, because you want a written record of everything, just in case you do end up in front of court and you need to prove something. But typically if there's a property management company, then.
I guess, and thank you for covering that, and then we'll get back to the zoning. The part that I wanted to kind of have to clarify is that the agent is equivalent to the actual owner.
Yes.
And in court, there is no necessity to prove that you contacted the actual owner.
No,
you serve,
correct.
Notice, the agent is equivalent to notifying the actual owner.
Correct. There's no legal distinction.
Contact the agent.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a few questions. The first one, or someone said, I filed my answer and asked for a jury trial. I got a notice for a non-jury trial. I don't have representation yet, and it's in a week and a half. What do I do?
Okay, so this is just kind of how it works. Even if you requested a jury trial, it might be a valid request for a jury trial, and it might have been done on time if you either paid the jury fees or filed the appropriate fee waiver to get those jury fees waived, you might still get a jury trial. The thing is that when plaintiffs or landlords request the trial, they always check the box that says they're requesting a non-jury trial. So it always gets set as a non-jury trial for the first date. Typically what happens at that non-jury trial is if the parties decide that they do want to go to court or they do want to go to trial, the tenant can say, Your Honor, I requested a jury trial. I'd like this set for a jury trial, in which case the judge will typically set it out however long, a few weeks or so, as a jury trial. And on that date, the jury trial will go forward. But the jury trial the request for a jury trial had to have been valid. And the jury fees either have to have been paid and waived, typically. This is a very specific question. I haven't seen any of the paperwork. I can't answer. But if, you know, you can request a jury trial and not do it correctly, and you end up not getting a jury trial. I will say, too, judges are almost always willing to continue a matter at least once if you haven't asked for a continuance before. So like if you show up to your first court date ever and you're not ready and, you know, for whatever reason, you try to work out a settlement in court with the landlord, can't work it out, and you go in front of the judge, you can request a continuance. You can request the judge set it out for a few weeks just so you have more time to prepare. That's something you can always do. They're not guaranteed to grant it, but judges are typically pretty lenient if it's your first time asking. If it's your second or third time asking, they're going to want a real good explanation for why you are putting it off.
So follow-up question is, if I lose, isn't it possible to get more than 5 days to be out? If so, how?
If you lose, so from the day judgment is entered to lockout is almost never just 5 days. It's usually a little bit more time because the landlord still has to take the writ of possession to the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department still has to come to your door. And even after the notice, 5 day notice to vacate expires, the sheriffs aren't necessarily going to show up on day six. Sometimes they're too busy. They show up sometime later. There are ways to get lockouts stayed or postponed. You can file a motion to or request to stay judgment of execution for hardship. There are specific rules about that. And if you do want that to happen, I really recommend getting an attorney because that is an actual legal motion. I do believe, and also there are self-help centers at every courthouse, and a lot of those self-help centers do help with eviction matters, and they might be able to help with a motion to stay. I just can't guarantee that.
Okay. Then they wrote, the ceiling in my one bedroom is falling down and I'm sure there's black mold. I've reported to the health department, but haven't gotten a response yet. Now landlord wants to have a painter come fix it, but I wanted to test it for black mold. I keep the door closed now and it's basically uninhabitable. What do? I just don't want it covered up.
Sure. Yeah, this happens a lot. You know, painting over mold doesn't get rid of it, it turns out. I'd say follow up with the health department and try to get them on and try to get them there if the landlord's not doing anything.
Could you push back if the landlord wants to come in and paint it? Can you say, I need a week or I want 2 weeks to buy you time?
Not. The landlord does have the right to enter to do repairs and remodels and things like that. So you can't necessarily stop the landlord from coming in and trying to fix the problem. If their attempt at fixing the problem doesn't actually fix the problem, then you can, you know, stay on that, try to get the health department out there. And there are black mold tests that you can buy that you can use. They're like home kits. And you can bring those in. And if you do that, you can bring those to the health department or, and then again, you can at that point withhold rent and say, I'm not gonna pay rent until this is fixed.
I was gonna ask kind of like a similar to that of like, yeah, if the tenant were to get a home kit tested, it turns out that there's black mold, like, yeah, could they also deduce that from the rent of like, well, you, cause I mean, also like coming over to paint, it doesn't really fix it. So it's.
Whether or not you can deduct a test from rent, I don't know. That's a gray area that I can't really comment on specifically. But if you do anything to repair the problem, you can try to deduct that from the rent. I'm pretty sure also the amount of the deduction can only be up to 1 month's rent. So if the cost of repairing it is more than 1 month's rent, typically you have to have the landlord do it or at least complete the problem entirely.
Sorry, just to follow up on that. If they did come in, paint over the mold, can you still do a home test and it'll still show whether or not there's mold, or is the fact that they paint over
you
see
it.
Yeah,
it'll eventually show up.
The mold will eat through it at some point. I don't know what a test will say. I don't know how sensitive they are, but black mold is, you know, it can linger in the air, or it can linger, you know, in carpet, especially in porous surfaces, it really sticks around. So if they're just painting over and it actually grew into other places, you could probably figure out or where it is. But I don't know how sensitive those home tests are. It may or may not work. Yeah.
Okay, last question. I disagree with the amount they say I owe because of my filing for COVID tenant eviction protection. Does this get discussed in court?
So the tenant protect, well, so I don't really have enough details to give a real clear answer on this, but there overstatement of rent in the notice is an affirmative defense. You can argue that if the notice demands more rent that the tenant owes, then that is a defense to eviction. However, because of, again, I don't know if this person lives in Burbank or City of LA or unincorporated LA County, and that can make a difference. But the state's COVID protections are expired. Like pretty much all the non-payment defenses have expired. And it depends on kind of what months the landlord is demanding in rent. It depends, because if they're just demanding like last month's rent and none of the earlier stuff, then that's enough to evict. You don't necessarily have to, understatement of rent is not a defense to eviction, only overstatement. So if they're evicting based on missing 1 month's rent, even though the tenant owes several months before that, that's something they can do. I will say though, arguing that you actually owe less might not necessarily protect you against eviction, but it could reduce the money judgment that you get if you lose, because you might not necessarily owe the full amount that they're claiming. If you do lose a trial, typically you get a money judgment for the full amount that the landlord is claiming that you owe, unless you have some kind of defense to show you don't actually owe that amount. And so you might be able to prove you don't actually owe that much, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to beat the eviction.
It's complicated too, because the early not payments became settled in.
Yeah. And that's also an issue, because if you turned in those declarations of financial hardship due to COVID, during COVID, then any of the rent that accrued during that time was converted into civil debt, which you can't be evicted for. But you, again, you had to have, you were supposed to have turned in those declarations of financial hardship, and then it depends on which months you missed and which months it stopped. So, and where you live. So I,
pre-COVID, that's the most normal reason for a default, or a, I can't think of a term for the declaration, right? It's a landlord accrued late fees. You can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there are rules like that. And like, you can't add certain fees and costs on.
It has to be rent.
It has to be rent. Utilities don't count. Like, it has to be rent. So yeah, there are arguments you can make in court, and you can argue the amount you owe. It's just not necessarily going to protect you from getting an eviction judgment.
Because they just followed up with, the rent was supposed to be delayed to 8/24. So I'm assuming August 2024.
Okay. I would refer this person to do, I would tell this person to do the stay house referral to see if they can get further legal advice or go to a workshop, because I can't really answer that question without more details. And yeah, as I said, there's no duty of confidentiality here.
If a tenant receives a 60-day notice of overtime rent that was due, what happens if they move up to the tenant for temporary? What happens to that over the
Yeah, so the landlord can still bring a civil claim against you for that rent, typically, unless it got paid off by the rent relief. But if you still owe the landlord rent, even if they try to evict you for another reason, the judge in an eviction case could potentially order that money judgment against you if the landlord asked for that money in the complaint. But typically in that scenario, the landlord can still bring a civil claim against you, either in small claims court or just civil court. You still owe that rent. And that was one of the things about all of the COVID protections, is they just deferred the rent. They didn't actually forgive any of it. So tenants still owed that rent. They didn't have to pay it at that time. But now those debts are coming due. Which is why I think Burbank now has a rent relief program. Is that correct? No.
Not for that. Separate for no fault.
Got it. Okay. And then also the city of LA just passed a rent relief program that they're implementing. And I think the application period is still open, but it was only open for like 2 weeks. So if you live in the city, I recommend checking it out.
It's LA City.
It depends where you live, and you know, there's such a patchwork of city, county, state, federal, that it really depends on where you are.
Alabama, out of the country,
they can serve you anywhere technically. If they want to pay a process server to serve you across the country, that's not unheard of. They can serve you out of the country as well. However, there are I would need to do a whole seminar on whether or not a court has jurisdiction depending on where you are or what's happening. But if you're a tenant in the city of LA, then typically they can serve you wherever. The courts in LA would still have jurisdiction. If they can't find you, they do have to try to personally serve you though. So if they try to serve you, they like 4 or 5 times, they knock on your door over the course of a week, you don't answer, they don't know, they can't find you. That's at that point, they apply for an application for order to post, and then they serve by substitute service, which is posting the summons and complaint on your door and mailing it to you. If you're still, and that's valid service, if you're still out of the country, if you're out of the country for that time and the 5 days pass and you don't file an answer, default judgment, is entered against you, and you come back and you find a notice to vacate posted on your door, you can get the judgment set aside by saying there are ways to get default judgments set aside. It's usually either through mistake, excusable neglect, or fraud of some sort. So like if you were out of the country for this whole time and they got a default judgment against you, then you file what's called a motion to set aside and ask the court to set aside the default judgment. And basically saying you weren't there. You couldn't have known this case was been going on. And we do see that a lot, actually. We do see tenants who come in, they learn that they've only been there. There's an eviction case against them when the sheriff show up with a 5-day notice to vacate on their door, and then they're freaking out because they don't know, they had no idea this was happening for whatever reason. And that could be, you know, sometimes perfectly valid reasons. They were in the hospital. Sometimes it's because the landlord just lied about serving them, which happens. We ran into a registered process server who claimed that they had served someone in San Bernardino like 10 minutes before they served someone in Santa Monica. So, you know, it's not always accurate. Yeah.
There's exceptions to military service too.
Yeah. As I said, whole seminar we could go into for valid service.
We've heard instances of landlords saying things like, if you're not happy with it, you can move out or you can go somewhere else. Is that considered harassment?
I mean, kind of. I mean, well, so a landlord, if a landlord is trying to coerce you to move, that could be harassment. If a landlord is trying to force you out in some way, if they're shutting off your services or if they're ignoring complaints about habitability, that could potentially count as harassment. That's self-help. That's illegal. And that they're opening themselves up to liability by doing stuff like that. If they're saying, oh, you're not happy with something that's out of their control, then just move. You know, I mean, it's not really nice of them, but not necessarily illegal.
It would have to be more actionable or lack of action.
Yeah, if it's something that is within their power to control and they're just doing nothing about it, then
it's their responsibility.
Yeah. And so, yeah, if it's impacting your health and safety, then typically that's something they do have a responsibility to fix. As you said, if it's, you know, entirely like aesthetic choices or something, then it is. It can also depend on what the lease says. You know, I've seen disputes over whether or not the landlord was obligated to hire gardeners to deal with like the front lawns. And, you know, that's not a habitability issue typically, but if the lease says either the landlord or the tenant's obligated to fix those, then that's what the lease, you have to abide by the lease at that point.
Do you have any examples of harassment cases or common forms of harassment that you could talk about real quick?
I would say utility shutoff comes up a lot. If a landlord intentionally shuts off utilities, then that's harassment and illegal. Changing the locks, that's just straight up an illegal lockout at that point. And the liability is $100 a day for every day you don't have access to your unit. I would say, and also, I mean, straight up discrimination. I've seen tenants called slurs of all kinds, or, you know, threatening to call government agents if they're undocumented, things like that.
So that would be
harassment. They're not allowed to do that.
Pretty,
yeah.
Yeah.
Discrimination.
That's discrimination based on based on citizenship.
Was it?
And you know, and I will say, your ability to enforce harassment or prevent a landlord from harassing you is kind of limited, again, because you're kind of stuck there unless you can find somewhere else to move. That is, you know, kind of one of the reasons, at least in the legal side of things, a landlord has a lot of the power, because the law assumes if you're a renter, you can just move. That's like kind of the basis of renting. You know, you're not stuck to the land. You don't own the property. You can just move. But this is also going back to like the 70s when you could, and the rents weren't going up by however much they're going up. Now, if you live in the city of LA, the city does have a landlord, or has a tenant, something called the Tenant Anti-Harassment Ordinance, or TAHO, which allows for civil penalties against the landlords for $10,000 per violation. It also allows the city attorney or the district attorney to bring a criminal misdemeanor against landlords who harass tenants, and they have not done that once since this thing passed. So it's really kind of on the tenants to enforce their own rights in that matter.
Have you ever witnessed somebody who's going on trial for violations, like a tenant against the landlord for violations?
Yes.
How's that going?
Actually, I think it was one of my first clients, I think, in 2021, was I think a Burbank resident, Burbank or Pasadena, one of them. And her landlord in the middle of COVID was trying to evict her for substantial remodel. That case didn't end up going to trial because we had requested a jury trial and jury trials weren't going forward. And the case had already been going on for like 6 months. So the landlord ended up just paying my client like a chunk of change to agree to leave. So it didn't end up going to trial, but if you do go to trial, the landlord has to prove their case is the thing. Like, they are the plaintiff. They have to prove that they have a valid reason for evicting and that they complied with all of the laws regarding eviction. If they're arguing that they're doing this for a substantial remodel and they can't prove that this work would take longer than 30 days, then that they might not, then you can say they haven't proved their case in this situation. And you can ask other people who are in the same building, who went through the same thing. You can ask them to testify and say, well, you know, this was the same issue and they didn't do it. But again, you're going into legal strategy there, and I can't really talk about it without going into really specific details.
I'll go in there and just get to that. Could you also just talk a little, we have time. Could you talk a little bit more about just security deposits specifically?
Sure.
Because I mean, like, for instance, some places will charge you first and last months plus a security deposit. We've seen a lot of that happen. We've also seen, at the beginning of the lease, there'll be like an additional charge for different amenities that are not included in the lease, but they are included within the contract.
Yeah.
After a certain time, we've seen some cases. I've heard of some cases where, like, after a certain amount of years, you can get charged another security deposit. It's a you go into like how does that?
Well, once again, the security, you know, require the limits on security deposits kind of do depend on where you are. I'm trying to remember whether or not the TPA has anything to say about security deposits. I'm pretty sure it can be. It's typically limited to first and last month's rent, as you said, or at least 2 months rent on top of it. Regarding if a landlord doesn't give you your deposit back, a landlord is obligated within 21 days of a tenant moving out to give the tenant an accounting of their deposit, which is they have to show an itemized list of deductions of the deposit and then whatever money was left they have to give you. If the landlord doesn't give you that accounting, you can send them a demand letter. And there is actually a very handy tool on the California Courts website that can generate a security deposit demand letter for you. You just put in your information and the landlord's information. You send that letter to the landlord. If they don't respond or they still don't give you the accounting and whatever's left of your deposit, if anything, then you can bring a claim in small claims court, typically for, I think, 2 or 3 times the amount of the security deposit. Because at that point, the courts assume malfeasance, and you know, they like to punish landlords for that. Charging for extra amenities at the end, I'm not certain what that would refer to. I mean, if they give you an itemized list of deductions from your security deposit and you don't think it's reasonable, you can challenge them on that. You can do the same thing, demand letter, you know, file suit if they don't do anything. I've seen that happen. I've seen landlords, charge like a lot for pretty minor fixes or fixes that the tenant. Yeah. So the landlord isn't allowed to. So if it's normal wear and tear, which is just like regular maintenance, the landlord can't reduce your security deposit based on that amount. It has to be like actual things that had to be fixed.
It's 100% refundable, except for rent and damages beyond normal wear and tear.
Yes.
If the carpet's 7 years old, you can't charge it.
Yeah, exactly. You can't substantially remodel the premises with your old tenant's security deposit, essentially. So.
What about adding fees? Like if you put 1 month's rent for a security deposit, and then like, I don't know, after you're there for a year and it goes month to month or 6 months through and they're like, oh, we want another $500 for the security deposit.
Oh man. So this,
you can raise it the same as you would rent.
Yeah. So you can raise a security deposit. You can ask for extra security deposit on top of a rent increase. And I know there were some landlords' attorneys that were using this as a strategy to raise rent in LA while there was a rent freeze. So it is something they can legally do.
They can only add as much as they increase the rent.
Yeah, so there are limits to how much they can increase the security deposit by. And
is this like codified in the law somewhere that we can look up?
It's 2 months rent or 3 months if it's furnished.
Yeah, what is
it? An additional half if you have a water bill, which I don't think anybody has anymore.
Fun fact, it's actually illegal to discriminate against people with water beds, too.
But that's what it was before.
That's something in the law. It's in the law. You can look it up.
It's not a void now.
Sorry.
The word's groovy on top of it.
Yeah. Sorry, you.
I have a question. For the defective notice, so let's say the landlord doesn't know that he or she have the defective notice. 60 days pass. And then I don't know what's going to happen after the 60 days, but then we're still here and then we know that. So what's going on?
Well, so at that point, once the notice expires, the landlord can file the complaint with the courts, and then they serve you with a summons and complaint, and then you apply the affirmative defense of the defective notice at court. And if you know the notice is defective ahead of time, you don't have to tell the landlord the notice is defective. You can wait for them to file the complaint and then just apply that defense at court. And there are ways to get cases dismissed without actually going to trial. There's something called a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which asks the court to basically rule on just the complaint itself. So like if a landlord is required to attach the notice to the complaint when they file it with the court, if you ask for a motion for judgment on the pleadings, you can point to the judge and say, look, the notice is actually defective.
A motion of what?
Motion for judgment on the pleadings.
A motion?
Motion for judgment on the pleadings, or MJOP. And it's basically a request that the court finds that the complaint itself or something within the complaint itself is defective, and therefore judgment should be entered in favor of the defendant.
So does that mean that whatever, like for this, it's just giving the people more time? Or if it's when it's dismissed, does that mean it's dismissed?
Yeah, that means the case is done, and they got to start the notice period all over again.
Oh, they have to do it. They can do it again.
Yeah. Well, they can always do it again. Like that's the thing. A landlord can file as many. They can go through this process as many times as they want. As long as they have valid reason to do so. Like if you got this case dismissed because the notice was defective, they can serve you with a new 60-day notice to quit the next day. That's valid. And then they have to wait for that one to expire, and then they file the complaint with the court again. But there's nothing saying that they can't file another one against you. They can't fix the problem and then file.
Unless you win by trial. Basically.
No, even if you win by trial, they can't. So if you win a trial, they can't bring the same claim against you. They can't bring the same claim against you because you beat it. But if they try to bring a claim against you for a new case or a new notice, that could be a different claim entirely. Now, they might be able to say like, oh, well, it's now it's actual. Now we're actually planning a substantially remodeled premises. However, there is also a presumption that any eviction after 180 days after you win at court is presumed to be retaliatory. So on top of having to prove their case all over again, they're also going to have to try to show the court, no, we mean it this time. We're not actually doing this just to retaliate. So a second time would be a lot harder, legally speaking.
But not impossible, right?
But not impossible. Nothing's impossible in court. It's
my
best and worst part of it.
Around income requirements for new tenants, you know, that's something that, you know, especially here in the city of Burbank, you know, there's a lot of landlords that require 3 times the income for the rent. And, you know, for a lot of tenants, you know, if they made that much, they probably would be renting. They would move. So, I mean, is there any way, or can you speak to that with regards to income requirements for rent?
They're legally allowed to do that. Landlords are not, you know, landlords can accept, you know, as long as they're not discriminating based on certain protected classes, they can pick and choose tenants however they want. They can discriminate based on how much money you're making. That's not a protected class, unfortunately. They just can't discriminate based on where your source of income is coming from. So if you do have Section 8 and you can afford it and you clear everything else, then they can't say, oh, we're not going to accept you because you're a Section 8 tenant. From my experience, you know, some landlords know that and will just try to find other reasons to reject a tenant. Some landlords don't and will just openly admit it, at which point you should just call the California Civil Rights Department and let them know you're dealing with discrimination. Income requirements are 100% legal. And unfortunately, you know, they can reject you if they think you're not going to be able to pay the rent. They don't have to take you as a tenant.
Wow,
I outlasted you all. All right.
Joke's on you. There's like 10 minutes left.
Well, I do have one slide left, but this is.
The 3 times the rent, or to 2.5, or even 2 times the rent. It's because if you're buying a house, the lender is not going to loan you unless you're making, like what I did, 38% disposable income. So that's somewhere between 2.5 and 3. So the landlord's using that just a different way of showing it. It's 30% inverted becomes 3 times.
And there's a presumption that if you're spending more than 50% of your income on rent, you are essentially, you're one paycheck away from eviction, and you're housing insecure.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that's a lot of people.
Right.
It is a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of how things go, right? I mean, like, you get an apartment where you're like, you do make those 3 times rent, but as rent increases keep going up, eventually you end up with 50%
yeah.
Exactly.
Or higher.
Yeah.
So, like,
and
landlord uses to check on that. That's something I
have stopped. I have seen instances where tenants were asked to recertify. And this typically happens when someone is taken off the lease or someone added on to it.
Mm-hmm.
This happened to me personally, actually. I was living with someone who moved out, and our income together was enough, but mine alone was not. And so I had to get my brother to co-sign because that was the only way they'll let me stay. And they can do that. If the terms of the lease change or the parties change, they can ask the remaining parties to recertify.
Part of that, both say, if you've been paying rent for the tenant for a year, the landlord's not going to try to make that an issue.
I mean, it depends how much they think, how much more rent they think they can get if they get you out.
What he was saying is that when the rent goes up and now you're making only 2 times the rent rather than you were making 3 times the rent, as long as you're a good tenant, you're paying the rent, the landlord's not going to actively try to move you out.
Yeah, and they can't demand, as far as I'm aware, unless
because you're a mom and pop landlord, but what about those corporations who are not like you're
a different beast?
Genuine monsters. I'll just say really quickly, Neighborhood Legal Services, it has a hotline if you're dealing with issues, legal issues. We do handle more issues than just housing. There's immigration, criminal, family law matters. NLS does have teams that help with that. And then the Stay Housed LA hotline is down there. You can give them a call. Again, Stay Housed attorneys are pretty swamped, so there's no guarantee. But the workshops are typically open to all, and they'll take all comers. So if you do just need some further advice and counsel, they should be able to help you.
Oh, I have a question. Those real estate agents, what if they harass us? Landlord's responsible.
Then the landlord's responsible for that.
Then what?
It also depends on how bad the harassment is, because like if it gets to the point where like there are threats of violence, then that's like a restraining order. Then that's at a point where you should be asking for a restraining order. If it's you know, just regular landlord harassment, or if it's just harassment of a landlord's agent, like you said, then yeah, you can sue them for harassment. I would always just try to make sure, just, you know, make requests that they back off first. It's always a good idea to try to settle the matter before going to court, or deal with the matter without the courts involved. The courts like to see that too. They like to see that you actually tried to fix the problem before you filed a complaint with them. But if you try to get them to back off and they're still harassing you, then you could consider your legal options. All right. Thank you all for coming. I should put my Venmo up here so you could, you know, send me money for a drink.